This is Nick Wiggins. Welcome to the first episode in the 2017 series of Future Tense. Our guest today is Anthony Fennell.
Thank you, Nick.
Occupation?
Broadcaster, Australian Broadcasting Corporation.
Your special subject is the rise of ignorance and what the future will be like in a world of dumb. Your time starts now. What do we call a person who has an opinion on everything but no evidence with which to support those opinions?
The new President of the United States?
Could you be more specific?
Ignorant?
Correct. In 21st century society, who's entitled to an opinion?
Anyone?
And on what subject matter are they entitled to express an opinion?
Everything.
Who voices opinions about everything?
Everyone.
Correct. And what is the study of ignorance?
Could I have that question again, please?
The study of ignorance. What is it called?
Study of ignorance. Let me see. The study of ignorance. Yes, well, ignorance. I've often thought that if a superior alien species ever visited Earth, they'd be in for a double shock. First, they'd be surprised at how much we individual Earthlings seem to know about anything and everything. And then, after they'd had a little giggle, they'd realise that most of us are just making it up. That much of what people say these days is based on nothing concrete at all. Some people now call it the post-truth world. But Stanford University's Robert Proctor is more likely to call it the age of agnotology.
Agnotology is the study of ignorance. It's also the cultural production of ignorance, sort of in the same way that biology is both life and the study of life. And I'd been thinking in the 1980s a lot about how powerful industries defend their products, chemicals, asbestos, tobacco, whatever, with science, with a type of science that is deception, is a form of deception. They'll say, we need more research, the facts are not all in, there's uncertainty, room for doubt. And I noticed this as a strategy in my history of science colleagues. We're not really looking at this. You know, we tend in the history of science to look at the greats, you know, the Newtons and the Einsteins. But people weren't looking at how science could actually be used as a form of deception, or even that the call for more research, you know, that there's doubt, that we need more research, that that could be used as a form of delay or inaction. And this was a new type of sociology of science. So I asked a linguist colleague of mine, Ian Bold, if he could coin a term that would designate the production of ignorance and the study of ignorance. And, you know, we came up with a number of different possibilities. And originally we spelled it agnotology with an A, agnotology. We got some protests from people who studied jawless fish, the agnathic fish. And so this, our science looked a little bit like the study of jawless fish. And so we put an O instead of an A and it became agnotology. The idea being that we're studying the logic of ignorance, really, how ignorance is produced and the ethics of ignorance, the geography of ignorance, the politics of ignorance, why ignorance can be used as a strategy to maintain certain forms of power. So ignorance functions in all these different ways and people weren't studying this. Everyone was studying knowledge, you know, ad infinitum, but no one was studying ignorance. So that's why I thought it'd be good to have a term for this and more people looking into it.
So agnotology it is, and Professor Proctor has few doubts that it has a robust future. His idea is that rather than just simply complaining about things like fake news and ill-informed comment, if we want to try and arrest the spread of ignorance in the future, we have to first understand it. And central to that understanding, according to Robert Proctor, is an awareness that ignorance is often deliberately manufactured.
I taught as an instructor in the biology department at Harvard many years ago in the 1970s, and that was a time when the tobacco industry was funding millions of dollars worth of research at Harvard Medical School, and some of the more radical medical students started complaining that Harvard could be hazardous to your health. The cigarette industry was creating goodwill, kind of witness farm sympathizers at major universities all around, and this was kind of diabolical, and people seemed to think the money was not tainted, when in fact, what they were doing is they were funding alternative causation. The cigarette industry becomes the leading funder of things like radon as a cause of cancer and asbestos as a cause of cancer and genetic theories of cancer and immunologic theories, basic biochemistry. they're invited to help plan Nixon's war on cancer in 1971, which is one reason the main cause of cancer in the modern world. Tobacco was ignored in the Nixon's war on cancer. So I started noticing that there were all of these trade associations that made as part of their entire denial campaign, we need more research. It was very clever because they were able to capture the high ground of liberalism or open-mindedness, saying don't close your mind and say that cigarettes cause cancer. You should be open to other causes, viruses, genetics, as part of their alternative causations.
And that type of tactical use of ignorance as a weapon, that's still something that we see within our public and political debate today, isn't it?
Yeah, it's huge. Anytime you have a dangerous substance, people will fund scientists to say that there's not enough evidence, that we need more research, that it's an open controversy. We see that with the NFL concussion question, where they used the tobacco playbook to say, oh, you know, concussions really aren't that bad. Or we see it in the sugar industry, which has been using the tobacco playbook for many years to say, you know, it's not sugar that causes obesity, it's fat. It's something else. The cigarette industry blames stress. So many of our modern theories that stress causes harm or that cholesterol, you know, causes heart disease. The leading researchers developing those theories were funded by cigarette makers in order as a kind of heat shield to take the blame off of cigarettes and put it on to something else. And this is now used in dozens and dozens of areas. Any producer of a product that's harmful is able to harness scientists to say, well, maybe it's not so bad for you.
And what sort of social conditions have to exist within a society for that type of agnotology to work best?
Well, I think part of it is the blame goes in our ideas about media and responsible journalism. If journalists think that the essence of every story has to have two sides, then basically you can end up balancing truth with lies. And so part of this is about responsible journalism, where you have to realize that sometimes there's only one side. It's not a two-sided coin. And just to air equal time for, you know, one view that's true and one view that's fraudulent can lead the public into some kind of hopeless despair. So a big part of it, I think, is to critique this journalistic balance routine, it's sometimes called, as if, you know, you have to get a quote from the Koch brothers every time you want to say something about global warming. Again, it's, I think, confusing of controversy. There are controversies about what to do about many things, but there's often not a controversy about whether, in fact, we're being harmed.
And yet that idea or that ideal of the balanced debate is often put forward in a laudable way as a solution to ignorance and the problem we have with facts within society at the moment.
Yeah, that's part of the problem. People equate open-mindedness with a kind of indecision almost, or firmness with a kind of closed-mindedness, when in fact some things are just true. You know, the earth is not flat. And to say there are two sides of that is just a fabrication and can be very dangerous.
1930s and 40s were warmer than the current decades. What's the data source?
Well, not exactly.
No, the original records are.
Just one second. You're hearing the interpretation of a highly qualified scientist, and you're just saying, I don't believe it. Is that right?
I'm saying that the data has been corrupted, and we know that the 1930s were warmer than today.
Yeah. Corrupted? What do you mean, corrupted?
Been manipulated. And,
by
and,
who?
By NASA.
NASA?
By the yes.
The people...
Hang on a second, guys.
No, this is quite serious.
No,
NASA.
I borrowed a term from anthropology. It was Bronislaw Malinowski who identified what he called phatic speech. That's a kind of talk in which people establish solidarity merely by an exchange of words.
John McIntyre, senior journalist with the Baltimore Sun.
You get this when someone says, how are you, while walking past and without stopping to listen to any answer. It's just an acknowledgement that I know you, you exist, we are colleagues. There's no point in going further after we have simply established this. And we have phatic conversations about the weather, not as if there's anything actually we can do about it, but we talk about the weather and we establish that we have a common ground of experience, even though, in effect, it doesn't really amount to anything.
And that's what's happened now to much of our journalism, says John McIntyre. It's become phatic. It's become so truncated and abbreviated and cliched that although it still has the pretense of being about the exchange of useful intelligence, it's often more about ritual and belonging than it is about genuine news.
It doesn't really mean anything. It doesn't really have any impact on us. It just exists to give us a sense that we are among that glorious body of the well-informed.
So in a journalistic sense, I mean, a good example of that are the news headlines that often appear on a crawl at the bottom of a news program that tell you very little. They're so abbreviated in many instances that it's impossible to know what they mean, and yet they are put up there as news headlines.
Well, I think it's not just the crawl. I think it's pretty much all headlines, because the ugly secret, and this is one that I think reporters in particular are not keen to understand, is that many people simply read the headline, think they have a grasp of the information contained therein, and proceed without actually looking at the text. Journalism has always been scattershot. We have all these stories in newspapers, broadcast, online, and we know that they're not going to appeal to everyone. We try to catch as great an audience as we can, but we know that there's lots of stuff that we call news that doesn't really interest people, and sometimes they just develop a superficial understanding of what we've written, and that counts as being well-informed people.
Now, when you look around, do you see more of this phatic journalism in certain outlets than in others, or is this pretty widespread?
Well, I think it has always been widespread, but I think particularly in online journalism, there's this barrage of information that is contained in 6 or 8 words of a headline, and you scan this television screen or this website, and you get this impression that there's all this information and that you are informed, while in fact you have at most a kind of sketchy understanding of anything that's going on anywhere.
So in a sense it gets in the way of communication, as I understand your argument, because it's adding to that general noise that's out there that makes it harder for us to concentrate on stories, say, in the journalistic sense.
There is, I think, now with this tremendous expansion that the internet has brought on, there is more and more noise, and there's less and less actual, reliable, verified information for you to get your hands on.
John McIntyre from the Baltimore Sun. And if you've learnt nothing else today in our look at the growth of ignorance, you at least now know 2 new terms: agnotology and phatic journalism. This is Future Tense, new ideas, new approaches, new technologies, the edge of change. I'm Anthony Fennell.
Research has shown that if you're repeatedly exposed to the phrase, the body temperature of a chicken, that's right, the body temperature of a chicken, even if no useful information is given about the body temperature of a chicken, you are more likely to judge as true this statement: the body temperature of a chicken is 34 degrees Celsius. It's not, by the way, it's actually closer to 41. But this finding highlights an important aspect of our psychology that plays a huge role in how we see the world. The things we're exposed to repeatedly feel more true. Now, the way this seems to work.
And the power of repetition is something we've long known about.
Wir sind entschlossen, unser Leben mit allen Mitteln zu verteidigen.
It was Joseph Goebbels, after all, who once said, "A lie told once remains a lie, but a lie told 1,000 times becomes the truth." Today, psychologists call it the illusory truth effect. Assistant Professor Lisa Fazio from Vanderbilt University in Tennessee.
Psychologists proved what advertisers likely intuitively knew already, and what we've been looking at is kind of why these effects occur and what are the boundaries of when the effects occur or don't.
Now, tell us about the research that you did specifically in this area, because you were looking at whether or not this effect was changed if a person knew a fact to be true beforehand, before the instance of repetition.
most of the previous studies had looked at these kind of plausible but unknown facts where people didn't really have any prior knowledge to use to judge whether the statement was true or false. And we were interested in what happens if you do have some of that knowledge. What if I give you a statement that you should, based on your prior knowledge, know is false? Do you still fall victim to this illusory truth effect and think it's more true if you hear it twice than if you've only heard it one time?
And your findings were?
Yeah, so what we did the study just like before, where participants read a bunch of statements, then they read some repeated statements, some new statements, and we found that even if you had prior knowledge, you still thought that the statements were more true when you heard them twice. So for example, if we only included participants who were able to tell us that a kilt was the skirt that Scottish men wore, they still rated the statement, a sari is the skirt that Scottish men wear, as more true when they heard it a second time, as opposed to only hearing it once.
So what do we put that down to? Why would that be the case, do we think?
Yeah, we think it has to do with this effects of fluency. So when you hear something for a second time, it's much easier for your brain to process it. And that kind of ease of processing is interpreted as fluency, and we tend to interpret that fluency as truth. So there's studies showing that statements in high contrast fonts are thought to be more true than statements that are harder to read in low contrast fonts. Statements that are kind of written simply in common language are more true than statements that are written in kind of complex grammar that's hard to decipher.
So given that we are processing so much information on an ongoing basis throughout the day, we take shortcuts, do we, in terms of processing that information? And so if the information is packaged in a simple way and in a repetitive way, we're more likely to take it up as being correct. Is that what you're saying?
Exactly. And most of the time, this is a really good strategy. It saves us a lot of cognitive effort. And just out in the world, things that you encounter more often are more likely to be true than things that you only run into one time. So kind of in general, this strategy works really well, but it can cause issues when you're dealing with someone trying to persuade you, as in advertising or politics.
Right now, we are not strong. Believe me, make America great again. We're going to make America great again. And, you know, my theme is make America great again. We're going to make America great again.
So the message so far in our look at the rise of ignorance is that not only can it be manufactured, but we as individuals can also be personally at fault for our lack of genuine knowledge. In other words, we shouldn't always blame others for the rise in ignorance. We should sometimes look within.
Well, the Dunning-Kruger effect is actually a whole family of effects, but the main one and the one that people are most interested in is the fact that incompetent people don't know they're incompetent. Actually, you can scratch that. They're not in a position to know that they're incompetent. That is, they lack the very skills they need to be able to recognize just how poorly they're doing.
And who better to explain the implications of the Dunning-Kruger effect than David Dunning himself, a professor of psychology at the University of Michigan. Overconfidence, says Professor Dunning, is often a barrier to true understanding.
The issue with a lot of us is that ignorance doesn't reveal itself in terms of, gee, I don't know the answer. Actually, what we find is it's astonishing how often people don't know an answer or won't admit that they don't know an answer. Ignorance reveals itself by having the wrong theory, the wrong fact, the wrong approach. So what people do is they're confidently following approaches or answers they think are right, even though they're 180 degrees wrong. So that's what we mean when people are more misinformed than they are uninformed. It's not that they don't know things. They know things. It just happens that those things are wrong.
And we all engage in this, don't we? It's not just an ignorant few out there.
That's right. This is a condition that visits all of us sooner or later. That is, no one is immune to this. Some people might have a more flamboyant version of this problem at times, but sooner or later, we all have pockets of incompetence that we don't recognize. We don't recognize the boundary between our expertise and our ignorance. That remains invisible to us, and that remains invisible to all of us. It's just a part of the human condition. There are times when it is functional to be overconfident or to portray overconfidence. When doctors are trying to diagnose a patient, they try to be careful, they explore alternatives, they have doubts, they're very careful, they're cautious. But when it comes time to convince a patient that, okay, this is the disease, and this is the regimen you should follow, then it's in the doctor's interest to be confident, because more times than not, the doctor's going to be right, and the patient's going to be better off if they follow what the doctor says. And they're more likely to follow a confident doctor than an unconfident doctor. Now, the doctor still has to be wary and watch out, because maybe they're wrong. So at some level, they should be cautious. But at some level, they also have to portray confidence to make sure another person's going to do what's best for them.
One of the things about ignorance that you've highlighted is the fact that from a very early age, we as human beings ascribe intentions and functions and purposes to objects and events. And oftentimes they turn out to be false. Just explain that whole scenario to us and why it's problematic.
What's interesting is I mentioned before that people tend to be more misinformed than uninformed. And part of that is that our psychological architecture, if you will, is set up to make certain mistakes or to have certain biases in their interpretation of the world. And one of the biases that we have, and you can see this in very young babies, is we sort of view the world as intentional. That is, when things happen, that's because some person or something out there wanted it to happen. And that may be very true when we're dealing with humans. I mean, humans have intentions, and a part of successfully navigating our human lives is figuring out what those intentions are. But people ascribe intentions to the weather. They ascribe intentions to chance events. They ascribe intentions to things that are mistakes rather than what was something that was done on purpose. And so what people will tend to do is they'll take a piece of wisdom or a quote-unquote bias that's useful in one area, but overextend it into areas where it shouldn't be extended. In some sense, sometimes that's what wisdom is, knowing when you have to stop with that bias because you've left the area where it's actually helpful.
We can see that with politics, can't we? That we operate in a world in which we have a subjective worldview. And because of that, we ascribe certain beliefs that we have from our previous experience to new scenarios, don't we?
No, I think that's right. And often what you see in an election is basically a contest between worldviews, in which both worldview might be wrong, either a worldview might be an over-exaggeration. One worldview might be more right than the other worldview, but essentially what we have is a competition between worldviews. And what's interesting, if you take a look at social life these days, it seems that what's happening less and less is we're talking less about our different worldviews to find out what other people think and how they might be able to change our minds. So people seem to be more encapsulated in little societies that really are their worldview. And it's going to be interesting to see what happens in the future, given that people have much more opportunity to do that encapsulation.
So we often don't recognize our ignorance in situations, and we overcompensate where it comes to our expertise. Is this being made worse in a world in which a high value is put on personal opinion and the expression of opinion?
Well, I think it actually goes beyond that. That is, we live in a world now at our fingertips where we have a wealth of information, and that information can add to knowledge. We can find out things about our health or about politics or about economics that can help us make wiser decisions. Or we could find information that's going to confirm prejudices or biases that we already have. And what we find interesting in our own work is sometimes the competition, if you will, or the source of distress and disagreement that you see in the political realm isn't a disagreement about priorities, or isn't a disagreement about worldview, or isn't a disagreement about values. It's a disagreement about fact. People literally believe that there are different facts on the ground in terms of what's going on in the country and in the world. So, for example, most Republicans in the United States think that Obama has been an economic disaster. All economic indicators, including the stock market, have gone down. Whereas Democrats will believe the reverse, but there are some indicators like poverty that are not going up or have just recently gone up in the United States. So that's a tougher type of disagreement to resolve.
David Dunning, in summary then, ignorance isn't necessarily about being uninformed. It's also about being misinformed and our willingness to stay misinformed. And with politics, we allow this to happen in large part because of the allure of political rhetoric. And if you want to understand the power of rhetoric, just think of American politics and of the ability of this man, an outsider with very little experience of government, who seemed to come from nowhere, to win high office by creating an army of unthinking, almost fanatical admirers through the power of his speech and the grand things he promised.
This is our moment to reclaim the American dream and reaffirm that fundamental truth that out of many we are one, that while we breathe, we hope, and where we are met with cynicism and doubt and those who tell us that we can't, we will respond with that timeless creed that sums up the spirit of a people. Yes, we can. Thank you. God bless you. And may God bless the
United States. Rhetoric is about the art of persuasion. And now we have many people from all directions, especially politically, persuading us of many different messages. So it's much more difficult for people to find, if there is one, an absolute truth when they go searching for it.
Patsy McCarthy is an adjunct professor in the Creative Industries Faculty at the Queensland University of Technology and a student of the power of rhetoric.
Ironically, when Aristotle first posited that the Athenian gentlemen needed to study the art of persuasion in order to protect their own land and rights in a time of no lawyers, Socrates spoke up very strongly and said, and he was a man who believed in absolute truth, that this might be a thing that could lead to trickery on the public.
And we know that if you look at, say, politicians in Germany, they try not to use rhetoric deliberately, don't they, because of their history with Adolf Hitler and the effect that his rhetoric had on the German population.
Well, I suppose so. I mean, it is just the art of persuasion, as Aristotle said. So I suppose what you're saying is they try not to use extreme rhetoric. And we say there's a difference between persuasion and propaganda. And I guess that the main difference of that is that propaganda tries to block out any other message, whereas a good rhetorical perspective could give you a balanced argument but still bring you out on the side of the one they want you to accept.
Why do we rely so much on feelings, particularly when we're looking at people who are trying to persuade us? You know, you often hear people listening to a debate who are swayed by a speaker because they get a good feeling about that person, not necessarily because of the detail that he or she might put out, the policies or the facts that they might present. Why are we so persuaded in an age, you know, of enormous education by those kind of gut feelings, do you think?
Well, perhaps it's a positive that we are such human beings, and often those of us who are more educated, we go by the feeling, but we find the rationalisations then to confirm the feeling. And perhaps that's a better way to go than the other, because at least we're not being cold about our approach and we keep the humanity there. I'm trying to be optimistic, but yes, ignorance, obviously, in a world that becomes more and more full of information, in a way it grows, because even when you're more educated, you begin to realise how much more you do not know.
Agnotology, the study of ignorance and the deliberate creation of ignorance. That was adjunct professor Patsy McCarthy. My thanks to co-producer Karin Savanovitz and sound engineer Steve Fieldhouse. I'm Anthony Fennell. This is Future Tense. Until next time, cheers.